And it is today's topical current. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday. Well, this hour we visit with neurosurgeon Dr. Eben Alexander and learn of his brush with death and subsequent recognition of spiritualism. He's written Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. And Dr. Eben Alexander joins us from Naples, Florida. Welcome.
Well, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Welcome, Dr. Alexander. Before we get to your journey into the divine, I'd like to begin with a look at your life before your illness in November 2008. What, if any, were your religious beliefs, and what were your ideas or feelings about God, prayer, and the spiritual realm? I know that's a big question.
Well, I had grown up in a religious home. My father was very spiritual. He was also very scientific. He was a neurosurgeon and actually headed up a training program. I had gone to a Methodist church growing up and wanted to believe in prayer and the power of prayer and God and afterlife. And I think there were certainly times in my younger years when I did. During my 20-plus years career in neurosurgery, I found it difficult to understand how consciousness might survive the death of the brain and body. And then, as I discuss in my book, I had an event happen in 2000 that had to do with the fact that I had been adopted and was then rejected by my birth mother in 2000. So for 8 years before coma, I had really completely given up on a loving personal God and had given up on the power of prayer. And my coma experience in 2008, of course, changed all that forever.
Right.
So describe that illness.
Well, it was very sudden. 4:30 in the morning, woke up just like being struck by a freight train. Severe back pain. I soon realized also had the worst headache I could imagine. I was already on the way down because at that point I could not put it together at all, and in fact, within about 3 hours, I had a grand mal seizure. My family called 911, and I remember nothing of the next 7 days. The EMTs came and packed me up, took me off to the ER, where they were finally able to break those seizures. I went onto a ventilator, was in coma for 7 days up on the intensive care unit. And the predictions by the end of that week is basically that I was down to about a 2 or 3% chance of survival with no chance of recovery.
So you,
that's when I started coming back.
Okay, you had this E. coli bacterial meningitis. Could you explain for us in lay terms what that is and how it affects the neocortex of the brain?
Well, the most important thing to point out, it was a very severe bacterial meningitis that my doctors agree to this day. They don't know how I got it, and they don't know how I had such a complete recovery from it, because by all rights, I really was down to that 2 or 3% chance of survival by the end of that week with no chance of recovery because of the damage it was doing to my brain. The best thing about severe bacterial meningitis in terms of analyzing my experience is that when you have a severe case like that that drives you into coma within 3 hours, it really is beyond question damaging the parts of the brain that make us human. The outer surface, the neocortex, is where all of our human consciousness is put together. Language, our rational thinking, everything we see, hear, all the emotional responses to it. Neuroscience says every bit of that conscious awareness for our entire life depends heavily on that neocortex to be intact. And that's why bacterial meningitis was such a perfect model for human death. And I really should have had no experience at all, given the severity and sudden onset of my symptoms. And yet, when I first came back, I remember this very vivid spiritual journey, even though I didn't remember anything at all of my life before coma. That all took about 6 weeks to come back afterwards.
So are you saying that God chose to save you from death?
Well, I think God's plan is really beyond our knowing. It took me a long time, because when I first came back from this, I was so completely blown away by the power of the experience. As I told my older son, who was majoring in neuroscience, when he came home from school 2 days after I got out of the hospital, I said it was way too real to be real. It was mind-boggling, and of course, the me before coma would have said such a patient should have no experience at all. So I was struggling to try and understand how this had happened. My doctors had told me enough about how sick I was, so I realized I should not have had any experience. And that's when I started this long process as my own worst skeptic, trying to understand how it could happen in the brain. And try as I could with the help of colleagues and multiple hypotheses that I discuss in the book, after several months, we came to realize that it was a very real experience, that it truly happened, but did not happen in my brain or in the physical universe. And especially because of similarities to other near-death experiences, it has very profound implications about the nature of our existence.
So let's turn to what did happen to you on the inside during these 6 days in coma. One of the things that's so remarkable that you say is that you had no earthly identity, just a consciousness. So tell us about what you experienced.
Well, it all began in a kind of a murky, coarse realm that was completely unresponsive. It seemed to be like I was underground or in dirty jello. I had no words, no language, no memory at all of my life before coma. And that's very important because of the nature of the journey that I had. And that's what I call the earthworm's eye view, and it seemed to last for a long time. But then I was rescued by this beautiful, spinning white light, a perfect, clear white light with an associated musical melody that was absolutely perfect. And that melody and that white light opened up like a rip in fabric around me in that ugly realm and were a portal into this beautiful, idyllic valley that in the book I call the Gateway.
Right.
And I was moving up through it. I did not have any kind of body awareness at all during this journey, but I was moving up through it because I was a speck of awareness on this lovely butterfly wing. And, of course, it wasn't a butterfly like you could identify here on Earth. This was that's just the best earthly word I can use to describe it. But we were moving up through this valley that was absolutely crisp and hyper-real, verdant, filled with blossoming flowers and blooms and dancing souls down below, lots of joy and merriment. And beside me on this butterfly wing was an absolutely beautiful girl who looked at me with this look of perfect love, far beyond our concepts of love in the earthly realm. It was very pure and unconditional. And she never said a word, but her thoughts came straight into my awareness. And when I wrote those thoughts up a few weeks later, when I was recovering, the messages that I interpreted from her, you are loved and cherished dearly forever. You have nothing to fear. There's nothing you can do wrong in this realm. And you will be taken care of, and you're infinitely loved. And it was the most comforting message. And just to even recall it now is just most wonderful and awesome bliss.
Dr. Alexander, you mentioned a melody that you
uh-huh.
heard. Can you hum it?
Yes. No, I cannot hum it. It actually is a melody that the notes worked several times, taking me back up in that realm, because I would go through that gateway realm and then even beyond that, seeing all of what we see is our universe and our space-time collapsing down, time collapsed down to a loop or a point, then a higher dimensional causality in what I call deep time, which is the realm of our souls between lives, our eternal souls, where we go through life reviews about our life, where we come into contact with the divine in its purest sense. But then even outside of that realm, with all of that collapsing down and going out to what I call the core, which was this infinite existence, because, in fact, the higher dimensional multiverse and all of eternity was collapsed into this complex, what I call an oversphere. That was part of the lessons that were conveyed to me. But in that core, in that infinite oneness, in that realm, it was filled with the love of the divine, with what we would all call God that is so far beyond descriptive words, but also filled with light from this beautiful orb and a strong sense of the three of us. And going into that realm, again, totally beyond words at all, pure conceptual flow. But I was told on entering that I was not there to stay, that I would be taught many things,
back. You have to give us a chance to get a word in edgewise, if you would. In the book, there's a quote, you say, "Death is an illusion, and an eternity of perfect splendor awaits us beyond the grave, complete with angels, clouds, and departed relatives." Did you meet your departed relatives?
Well, I did, and of course, the important thing to understand is that I did have originally what I interpreted as amnesia from my life before coma. So I went into this with my memory having been blanked out, which I attributed to the meningitis, wiping out my neocortex. And in fact, the beautiful girl on the butterfly wing was a tremendous clue, but I did not recognize her at the time. And to me, it was a big mystery that my father was not there. He had passed over 4 years earlier, and yet he was nowhere to be found.
Kind of sounds like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Well, you know, it might to some, but this world is so far beyond earthly descriptors, and even though you know, my description, I'm stuck with earthly words and earthly language, and yet people who have been to this realm, and that includes thousands who have reported near-death experiences and many others who have done this through meditation or centering prayer who have gone to that realm, they realize it is really not one that flows with kind of an earthly, you don't see with the eyes, you don't hear with the ears. It's a completely different realm. It's hard to put into words. And yet it's more real than this one. It makes this one seem dreamlike by comparison.
We're speaking with Dr. Eben Alexander. He's a neurosurgeon, 25 years, including 15 years at the Brigham and Women's and Harvard Medical School in Boston. The name of his book is Proof of Heaven. On today's Topical Currents, we'll come back with Dr. Alexander and take some calls and emails. Stay with us.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we're joined by Dr. Eben Alexander. He's the author of Proof of Heaven. He's a neurosurgeon. Doctor, are you still practicing?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm old school, which means if I operate on people, I need to be there 24/7. This is not allowed time for that. I'm very busy telling my story to people and getting the book out there.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, that's easy enough. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
Doctor, I read your book, and I know that the fact of your adoption had a big impact on your life and your feelings about yourself. Do you think that that experience in any way related to your experience with your journey to the divine?
Yes. I mean, as I explain in the book, to me there were some significant correlations between them, and I certainly draw the analogy that my kind of being lost and that sense of abandonment that I felt from the adoption scenario. And again, I had adjusted very well to my adoption in my early and middle years, and it was only that my son was doing a school project on family genealogy that I went back down that pathway in the year 2000. And that was kind of my undoing that led to my feeling, in a sense, orphaned by not sensing that connection I had with my birth mother. And I use that analogy in the book because of our worship of kind of secular materialism and the scientific view of materialism that takes away a connection that we all share that's very deep and powerful with the divine.
Well, you finally met your birth parents. How did that change your life at
that
time?
Well, I finally met them in the year 2007 in October, and it did a lot of good towards healing the separate nature that I had felt, especially for those last 7 years before that time, because of that presumed birth family rejection back in 2000. But in fact, it did not take me all the way to knowing the power of prayer and of that all-loving God, which is what I lost in 2000 with that rejection. However, in 2008, when I went into coma, everything that I learned on that journey brought me completely back into knowing the reality of God and of the eternity of our souls, as was proved very clearly by my journey in coma.
What is your definition today? Well, no, what was your definition of consciousness before your illness, and what is your definition of consciousness today?
Well, I think the definition in some ways is the same, although I've come to a completely different understanding about the relationship between mind, brain, existence, and all of reality. And consciousness, when I talk about it, is really, in its simplest form, what we all know best. Moment to moment, it's our awareness of self and of existence. And I had always assumed that that consciousness was created by the physical brain. And I assumed that if we understood enough about the subatomic world and physics, chemistry, biology, that someday that would explain how the brain created consciousness. And what my journey showed me very clearly is that is not true. The brain does not create consciousness. The brain serves more as a reducing valve or filter that allows consciousness to manifest in this kind of limited here and now. But it basically dumbs down consciousness to the trickle that is necessary for our existence in the physical world. And it's through near-death experiences and other expanding of consciousness, which includes centering prayer and deep meditation, that we're able to get a much grander view of our true consciousness, which obviously does not go away when the brain and body die.
Doctor, the title of your book is Proof of Heaven. Then is there hell as well?
Well, my belief on that is no. The all-powerful, all-loving God that I encountered on this journey, which I think is the same God we can all get to through prayer and meditation, that God was not one who would be creating an eternal damnation for failed souls. Part of my journey is understanding that the thing that makes more sense is that we do go through multiple reincarnations here, and that I have to look at our journey not as just birth to death, but as a much grander journey of our souls with soulmates, connected with the divine, that between lives we go through life reviews, as is commonly reported in near-death experiences. And there's no need for a hell, because as we deviate from love, from compassion, forgiveness, acceptance, and loving our fellow beings, any of those transgressions, we have to relive in our life review and feel the pain that was caused to others. So, in fact, there's no need for a permanent hell, and I can tell you that I think my belief is that the concept of hell came from that kind of life review, because one who had led a life giving out pain and suffering to others would feel tremendous pain when they have to feel it in that realm. They have to feel all the pain that they gave out to others, just as the others felt it, but even worse, because it's felt in the spiritual realm.
There was
no need for a hell, but this is all about learning lessons, and that's why we have the life review that precedes a new incarnation.
Let's take a call or two. Of course, we have a full board. This is Freddie in Miami. Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call, Doctor. I appreciate your interview and your insight. And as a medical doctor believing in science and logic, can you tell me the time frame that a patient has between a cardiac arrest and total brain shutdown? That's my question number one. And number two is real short. If you had this wonderful experience, why come back?
Well,
thank you. I'll take the answer.
Let's go to question one again. I think I need you to clarify a bit about what you're looking for there.
Well,
with question one.
Thank you for spending time with me. Well, I don't want to share the experience that I had in the hospital.
But what's the question about a time frame?
Let's assume a patient goes into code blue.
Right.
And after a certain time period, they're unable to resuscitate this patient.
Okay.
How long does this patient have from a neurological and brain activity point of view before the brain totally shuts down? The heart is gone. You can't revive it.
Right. Well, I mean, the general teaching on that is after about 4 minutes of no flow at all, you start to have damage. But, of course, if you have successful CPR efforts, if you've got a good medical team maintaining oxygenated blood flow, that period can go for a long time. You know, I think realistically, one would not consider it practical beyond about 45 minutes, but you can maintain some blood flow that would sustain the brain in that kind of setting. And your second question was about what?
And my second question, thank you, doctor, for being patient. My second question was, if you had this divine experience, why come back?
Well, I think it's important, again, to point out that we all have a purpose here. And, of course, I came to see that my particular story, when you get into the details of it, is very strong evidence for the eternity of our souls. In fact, I would say it's a very strong proof for that, which is consistent with a lot of scientific efforts to understand non-local consciousness, that is, consciousness, our way of knowing things that do not come through sensory pathways. And it turns out that reincarnation is the best way to interpret so much of my journey. So I know that when we go to that realm, it's only to learn lessons that we need to finish off in a life review, but then we come back here. So it's not, it's multiple lifetimes building towards that oneness with God. But we're here for a reason. I mean, this is what I see as soul school. This is where we are to manifest that love, compassion, and forgiveness. And there are reasons for this existence. So even if one goes there, you know, between lives, you're coming back here to get it better and better in the ascent of our souls.
Doctor, your doctor, Scott Wade, an infectious disease specialist, weighs in at the end of your book, one of the appendix. So how does he explain your remarkable recovery?
Well, I would say my doctors to this day do not think there is a medical explanation. And I think most doctors who take care of patients very sick with severe bacterial meningitis, especially mine, very rare E. coli, that almost never happens in adults. But patients who take care of bacterial meningitis, when the patient gets that sick that quickly, goes into coma within 3 hours, it's a very bad sign. And I think most doctors would agree to go into coma that quickly. The glucose level in my fluid around my brain, normally 60 to 80, in a bad case of meningitis might go to 20. In my case, it went all the way down to 1. My exam showed that I lost all neocortical function really within that first day. I shouldn't have had any recovery at all. So there is no medical explanation for my recovery. But I think that there are other explanations that are much deeper about our soul and our divine nature that had to do with my recovery.
Let's take a few more calls. This is Messiah in Cooper City.
Thanks for taking my call. Love your show. I called in, came in late on the show. Doctor, I have a question for you and a comment. What was your religious affiliation before this experience?
It's Methodist, right?
Yeah, I had grown up in a Methodist church. I was married in an Episcopal church. As I said earlier, I had seen less and less way that afterlife and consciousness beyond death of brain and body could happen, given my 20 years in neurosurgery. But now it makes much more sense to me. I spent 8 years basically agnostic, not believing in any kind of personal God or power of prayer before my coma. Now that's all changed forever. I know that that God is very real, that prayer is very powerful, and that our lives have far more meaning than I ever could have known before.
Yeah, what was the other part of your question, Mr.?
Okay, and I'm happy that you know there is a God. And when I heard you explaining your experience, it sounded like what Buddha experienced. You know, the bliss. He experienced the bliss. There was a young woman, and then Buddha was changed forever. You know, that's basically what you're explaining. What do you have to say on that?
Well, I think that as one gets into the mystical aspects of many religions, that would include Kabbalism and Jewish mysticism, or Christian mysticism, or Buddhism, Sufism in Islam, you find that all religions seem to converge on a common truth. And although people say that my journey, especially that when I came back, the sound that I remembered associated with that all-powerful deity, I mean, I hesitated to even use the word God because for me that word was too limiting. And any human words fail. They fall short of describing the awe of that creative source. But to me, all those mystical traditions converge on that one reality of an all-loving, all-powerful, all-knowing God inside each and every one of us as our conscious awareness. And that, you know, you don't have to almost die to get this, going using centering prayer, deep meditation, sometimes what I call the gift of desperation. People come to knowing that oneness and the power of that Almighty that's within each and every one of us.
We're speaking with Dr. Eben Alexander. He's a neurosurgeon. The name of his book is Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife on today's Topical Currents. Doctor, we have a emailer, Fritz. Neuroscientist Sam Harris and neurologist Oliver Sacks agreed that to deny the possibility of any natural explanation for an NDE, or near-death experience, as Dr. Alexander does, is more than unscientific. It's anti-scientific. The one most plausible hypothesis in Dr. Alexander's case is that his NDE occurred not during his coma, but as he was surfacing from the coma, and his cortex was returning to full function. It's curious that he does not allow this obvious and natural explanation, but instead insists on a supernatural one. How would you respond to that, Doctor?
Well, I think some important factors to bring out. The details of my story, which I report in the book, very important to know those six faces I saw at the very end of this long odyssey of repeated journeys up through those realms. Which to me seemed to take months or years to occur, even though my coma was only 7 days long. Those journeys through that realm all happened between days one and five. And I can say that because of the six faces I saw at the very end of it all. That five of those faces were people who were there in the ICU room the last 18 hours I was in coma leading up into the morning of the seventh day. The fact they all were seen at the very end of it, and that I did not see faces of those who had been around in the ICU during the first 5 days is very important in timing this. It all happened before that sixth day and seventh day when I started to come out. In addition, after I woke up from coma, after they pulled out the breathing tube and took me off the ventilator, I spent the better part of the next two and a half days kind of in and out of a period when my brain was trying to come back online, and I had a intermittent kind of a nightmare, a paranoid delusional state that was filled with language, unlike my deep coma experience, which was ultra-real and pure conceptual flow. That period after coming out of coma, which was delusional and psychotic and in and out of a dream state, but interspersed with my talking with people around me in the ICU, those memories seemed very vivid at the time, but they faded very quickly afterwards. And that would be a psychotic hallucinatory nightmare. That's totally different from what happened to me deep in coma.
Let's go back to some more calls, critical. Doctor, if you would. This is Alexander in Biscayne Park. Hi. Alexander, you're up.
Yes, sir. Hello. How are you?
Good.
Fine. Doctor, it's a pleasure. Joseph, this is a great show. I listen as often as I can. I'm calling because when I was about 13 years old, had a near-death experience. I was raised by parents who follow Premrawat Maharaji, very loose sort of Hindu-based spiritualists, even though we are locals, you know, whites from Miami. But this near-death experience, even though I was only out for short hours, the way that you described the different sort of interface that we have with it, it's not the physical interface with our bodies. It's completely beyond that and unfiltered. I remember to this day how strange it was, and still, I think it's so strange to have hands and feet and move around with these physical limitations. But the realization that I had, and the reason why I'm calling, is to maybe add a little bit more insight onto the true nature of what happens and what happens and what can happen is that it wasn't as if I was with a God. It was that I was a part of a God, a part of it as in one of its parts. But there was no point where I ended and anything else began. It was more along the lines of, if we think about it in a scientific perspective, the space between the charges in an atom, or the Higgs boson, or the electromagnetic spectrum, how nothing really ends or begins. However, our brain filters out so much that we're separated from the world around us, from nature, from true nature, which if we listen to Science Friday, we can hear about all these filaments of galaxies. It's so big and so small that we're really just locked in this microcosm where we think of ourselves as independent beings. And that's really where, for me, a lot of the fear that I'm sure that we all feel that turns into other emotions generates. Because all emotions are basically either fear-based or love-based. And my question for the doctor is, and excuse me for taking up so much time, is would you agree that the moment that we have now in existence isn't the past and it isn't the future? So the past and the future aren't real. Those are only memories. But the matter in which when we travel to this Akashic record or astral plane or whatever it is that we call it, the dimensions sort of fade away, and time is the most interesting. What happens with time? Because when I was out, and I'm now a Reiki master, and I practice a lot.
Right.
You want to let the doctor respond?
Oh, yeah. If you go to my website, lifebeyonddeath.net, there's a page there with a lot of interviews where I cover a lot of these topics. You're exactly right. I mean, as I point out in my book, time flow in that realm is completely different and completely free compared to time flow in this realm. And understanding the nature of time and space, and in fact that what we see is this very real material realm, is basically illusory. And, of course, Einstein and others knew this long ago, and they talked about it, how modern string theorists and those in search of quantum gravity, I mean, they all converge on the same thing, which is the material world is not what it appears to be. And the important lesson is that the thing that really exists is our consciousness, our soul, our spirit. That's the thing that does exist. And that's where I go in a lot of the other interviews, if you go to those, or where I'm going in my second book, which is going to take me a while to finish. But
Doctor, we have a caller that has a relation to what you've just been talking to. This is Darren in Miami Beach. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Doctor, thanks so much for writing the book. I find it fascinating and giving people the opportunity to develop a sense of spirituality through science, I think, is tremendous. Can you talk a little bit more about maybe how some of the theories of quantum physics relate to your experience?
I think the most clear-cut thing to point out is that a lot of the founding fathers, very brilliant physicists, Niels Bohr, Erwin Schrödinger, Sir James Jeans, Werner Heisenberg, they were driven into mysticism because the results of the experiments about the nature of reality suggested that consciousness was a far deeper mystery than they were allowing. And I think that's a huge part of where this goes. If you look at the interpretations of quantum mechanics over the last 100 years and see physicists kind of wrestling with different models to try and explain it, a lot of the enigma is wrapped around the fact that you're trying to get to some kind of deterministic model within the material realm.
Right.
And I think that's why they kept hitting a wall. And so the way I see consciousness, soul, spirit, is primary, and at one, our consciousness is all one, and at the deepest levels, of course, completely divine and one with God. And as people start to realize how that impacts things, it certainly helps me to understand much more richly what's going on in those quantum experiments. But it gets right down to what you're saying about time and space, past and future, not being what they seem to be. And that's something I'll go into in my second book about the higher causality of our spiritual existence.
Terrific, terrific. Do you experience when you're doing the hemisync, the vibration, similar to how Robert Monroe described it?
Well, I do. I've felt that from the very beginning with all that. I now work with a group called Sacred Acoustics in developing advanced binaural sounds to help in getting into deeper conscious states. But, yes, I mean, the vibration is something that's very familiar as one gets close to out of body.
Thanks so much, Doctor.
Thank you. Would you explain, tell us what the Monroe Institute is and what hemisync is?
Well, it turns out I'm working now more with Sacred Acoustics, and it's kind of the next generation of the binaural beats and what Monroe developed that he called hemispheric synchronization. The general idea I first heard about 2 years after my coma is that certain sound patterns could synchronize electrical activity in the neocortex, in the two cerebral hemispheres, and that, in fact, Monroe had used that to enhance non-local consciousness, in his case, out-of-body experiences, remote viewing, things like that. To me, it sounded fascinating because I thought I could duplicate what had happened to me in coma. The biggest surprise was as my brain was dumbed down by meningitis attacking the entire neocortex, I hit a level where all of a sudden the blinders came off and everything opened into a much richer, ultra-real world. And that made no sense given my conventional view of brain creates mind. And that's what fueled my interest in going into sounds and how they can influence deep transcendental states. And I think they free us up into non-local consciousness. Again, if you go to lifebeyonddeath.net, I go into that in a little more detail in explaining it.
We're speaking with Dr. Eben Alexander. The name of his book is Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. On Topical Currents, another short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with neurosurgeon Dr. Eben Alexander, and we're talking about his book, Proof of Heaven. Another caller, this is Paula. She's in Hollywood. Hi.
Hello?
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello? Oh, hi, yes. So I'm calling because I have a question about his experience, of course. I went through a similar experience when my son was born, and what I remember was that I knew I would not stay on the other side, although it was very fascinating and very inviting and welcoming. But I knew I had to come back, and I was given a mission. Now, I would like to know if Dr. Alexander also had this type of revelation, and what would be his mission now that he went through this experience?
I would say that we all have a purpose in life, and certainly I was given a mission, although I must confess I was kind of slow on the uptake, and my doctors kept telling me you were too sick for anything to happen. I kept knowing that I'd had this profound experience and wanted to explain it somehow, initially as brain-based, but then I came to realize, no, it wasn't based on the brain at all, but it was absolutely real. And many people, as I started giving talks on this, would tell me, don't you think you came back for a reason? Again, I must confess to being a little slow on the uptake, but I finally got to a point where I realized that I did come back to share aspects of my journey and to try and help wake people up. And in a sense, it's really by confirming that that millions of stories out there that people have help to take the lid off and make us all aware of this. I would highly recommend people visit Eternia, Eternea.org, the site that I started with my good friend John Audette, because that explains a lot more about spiritually transformative experiences, bringing science and spirituality back together, and you know, the power of these journeys. Plus, it offers people the ability to tell their own stories and leave them in the database at Eternia.org, which we can use to study this phenomenon and help to explain it more in a scientific sense.
Yes, okay. Please, thank you. Yes, I'm very curious now to read your book, and I really admire your description that is so vivid and so similar to what I had seen. So I'm very I'm very driven to read your book right now. Can you please tell me again the name?
Thank you very much. A lot of people just need to be affirmed that they're not crazy, you know. I mean, obviously for me to come out with this, I had to realize the truth and power behind it. And a big part of my journey is to help others tell their stories, because that's where the real power is going to lie in changing this world.
The name of the book is Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife, Paula.
Yes, no, the site that he just mentioned.
Is Eternia.org.
And also lifebeyonddeath.net. But Eternia.org is where you can leave your own experience.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Doctor, I wanted to ask you how much pushback you've gotten from the scientific community or members of, you know, doctors that you knew before your experience or that you still know. What kind of response have you gotten?
Okay, I would say that certainly within medicine and medical science, there are two groups that kind of jump on board pretty quickly with all this. The first group are those who know a lot about consciousness, neurosurgeons, neurologists, neuroscientists, because they realize that the materialist model of brain creates mind is false. It's horribly inadequate, and it doesn't work at all to explain the observations. So people who know about consciousness. Now, also, are those who spend a lot of time with patients who are making the transition, whose physical bodies are dying, especially hospice nurses, ICU nurses, plus physicians who spend a lot of time with their patients when they actually make that transition over. That whole group knows this is very real. They know that our souls are eternal. They've seen enough evidence of it. Again, I have to admit to my kind of being slow on the uptake, because I'd seen such examples back before my coma, you know, when a patient made the transition and left their physical body for good, and I just assumed that there had to be some explanation in the materialist model, even though I was very perplexed and didn't see how it could happen. Now, of course, I see it from the other side and realize that, of course, it makes much more sense to know that our souls are much more, that the consciousness is not created by the brain at all, but that our soul and spirit is eternal and is part of what creates all of reality.
And we'll take another call. This is Vicki, Pompano Beach. Hi.
Hello?
Vicki,
hi.
Go ahead.
Yes, yes. Hi, Doctor. My question is, you just spoke on how you don't have to be near death to experience what you experience, and I want to know how would I tap into that and feel that? And then how do you even translate it so that people will understand? I mean, you did a very good job in your book describing what you felt, but how, I don't even think I would be able to find words to even...
Well, I think that's true. And in fact, the one point I make in the book and in some of my presentations is one doesn't have to almost die to get this. And the pathways that allow people to get in touch with it, centering prayer, deep meditation. I think any form of meditation where you get into a daily practice, I spend 2 or 3 hours a day in meditation, but it can take months and years to start getting to some of these deeper truths, and it ends up changing our consciousness for the better and putting us more in touch with that. But that's how I would suggest it. I mean, often people are blessed with what I call the gift of desperation, where in some horrific moment where they feel like all is lost and there's no way to keep going, they often are given that gift of awareness that God is absolutely real and is right there with them. And I'm sure there are many who are listening to this broadcast who know exactly what I'm talking about. But in general, the best way to strengthen that connection is through centering prayer, deep meditation, anything that involves turning off the little voice in our head. That little voice in my head is not my consciousness. My consciousness observes it, but there's much deeper wisdom as I turn off that little voice and go deep inside and come into touch with this. And it's something that gets better and better with prolonged meditative experience.
Doctor, have you, since your illness, successfully experienced the same spiritual realm you did while in coma?
Well, yes. As I said, I'm a... My research interest now is in using various sound modalities, which my original introduction was with that binaural beats that I had found with Monroe Institute, but now with sacred acoustics, moving beyond that. And people who are interested can go to sacredacoustics.com to check out their downloads and learn more about it. But I work with them on a frequent basis because I believe that these kind of audio files and also going deep into some ancient forms of music enable us to get into transcendental states that put our awareness right there with non-local consciousness. And that is the pathway that I see pursuing in enriching our knowing about this, because you can read books, go to presentations, watch the DVDs. At the end of the day, if you really want to know these truths, you need to go in there yourself, because the answer is within us all.
You said you're writing another book now, and obviously with the meditation and with the message you want to convey, do you think you'll ever practice neurosurgery again?
Well, I do want to get back into patient care at some point, and I can assure you it will not be as a Mr. Fix-It neurosurgeon, you know, brain tumor, take it out, aneurysm, clip it, because now I have a lot more to offer patients about kind of the bigger meaning and knowing of our existence, which is multiple lives, that birth to death is just one tiny part, that our existence and relationships with soulmates are so much grander, a whole different way of looking at healing and at disease, hardship and difficulty. Those are all gifts in our lives, opportunities for growth of our souls. And this is where I'll be going with my second book, is explaining this in a lot more detail. But people can get these answers best by going into their own consciousness through meditation and centering prayer.
Well, Dr. Alexander, we want to thank you very much for joining us today. It's Dr. Eben Alexander. The name of his book is Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. And his website is lifebeyonddeath.net or eternia.org. Is that right, Doctor?
Yes, eternia.org.
Well, thank you very much.
Very much for having me.
Thank you.
My pleasure. And thanks for joining us this afternoon. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives. Caroline Brader Watts directed today. Online producer is Paul Leary. Want a friend to hear today's program? We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Click on radio to proceed there. Also, more information at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And tomorrow we get the full picture of Florida's largest Ponzi scheme. Attorney Scott Rothstein built investors and charities of $1.4 billion. Quite a haul for a boy born in the Bronx. And to the calendar, on this day in 1791, 220 years ago, the birth of James Buchanan, in Cove Gap, Pennsylvania, the only president from Pennsylvania, and also the only president to never marry. He was succeeded, of course, by Lincoln. And on this day in 1813, 200 years ago, the birth in Vermont of Stephen Douglas, the little giant. He died in Chicago of typhoid in 1861. One more while we claim executive privilege. On this day in 1985, 28 years ago, the death of North Carolina Senator Sam Ervin, who chaired the Senate Watergate hearings in 1973. Ervin was first elected to the Senate in 1954. And we leave with a quote from the colorful Senator Sam from Morgantown, who was chosen to chair the Watergate Committee by Majority Leader Mike Mansfield. Quote from Senator Sam: "There is nothing in the Constitution that authorizes or makes it the official duty of a president to have anything to do with criminal activities." This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned next for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.